their secretaries better than they treat their wives when it comes to common courtesy. Well, ladies, don't get too puffed up, because that same study showed that most women are more courteous to the checkout boy at the grocery store than they are often to their husbands. Well, part of that's the difference in living together versus only seeing people occasionally. But if we had the same common graces to our mates that we tend to have to others, even if we have to pretend on occasion, it would probably be good for most of our marriages. Marriage is a marathon, and you will need some rest along the way. I believe it is healthy sometimes for the ladies to go shopping with their girlfriends and the men to go hunting and fishing or whatever. In my particular line of work, Donna and I have just built-in vacations. For her, a vacation is when I'm not there. And I understand that. But there are some of you who probably your husbands are never apart. And some of you make that work. I don't know how well that would work for us, but if it works for you. But I do think there are times when we, even Jesus, need to go away and be alone. I'm not talking about abandonment. I'm talking about sometimes just needing to be alone. But remember, our love, your love for your mate, is an obedience factor to God, because God commands us to do it. And he doesn't say, love them when they're lovable. That's when it's easy. Someone shared with me, and I won't say who it was or what it was. Someone was referencing another couple that every night before they go to sleep, they look at each other and say, I love you. But the person said, but sometimes, some nights it's harder to say than other nights. And sure it is. There's sometimes when we may love them and not like them. I always remember the little note that Charlie Shedd, who's done some writing on this, he said he went home one day and on the refrigerator, we all put notes on the refrigerator, his wife had, they'd had a little spat, and it said, Dear Charlie, I hate you. Love, Sally. Ah, you can relate to that, can't you? Yeah. So I don't know that that's a bad note to write. When I first heard it, I said, well, that wouldn't be a good way to be, but then it's not too far off track. Dear Charlie, I hate you. Love, Sally. Always remember, though, that we have a God that can give us the power to be the husbands and wives that we need to be. And you can't do it by yourself. Remember when I said those three words I get out of Ephesians 5 are God, love, and respect. And I don't want to leave you with the idea that I think respect is all on the women and love is all on the men. Because women, you respect your husbands, hopefully because you love them. Husbands, you respect your wives, hopefully because you love them. But there is, I think, a gender emphasis there that we do need to keep in mind. Okay, I'm going to pause here and see if anybody has a comment or a question you would like to share with us. At this segment before I deal with something else. Okay, I'm not getting any. I'm sorry. We got Tom.
Along with your line of the holiness of our family, I think of the passage back in Malachi. I think I may have used this the other day, but I'll draw it to attention again. Back in Malachi chapter 2, we're talking about marriage and bearing children. In Malachi chapter 2, beginning in verse 14, it says, because the Lord has been witness between you and the wife of your youth, and on down in the verse, yet she is your companion and your wife by covenant. And verse 15, it makes mention that he made them one. And why one? He seeks godly offspring. The holiness of our family has an influence definitely on the next generation, not just the relationship between husband and wife, but the way we conduct ourselves is going to reflect in the lives of the next generation.
Absolutely, and most of us learn what we at least think marriage should be like from what we have seen. Now, sometimes we learn what marriage shouldn't be like by what we have seen. But either way, we learn by what we have seen. Most of us bring to our marriage relationships an idea of what a marriage ought to be based on what our parents had. And sometimes that's good. For many of you, that was a good example. But for not everybody, is that a good example? And for nobody, is it a perfect example? Anybody else have a comment or a question you would like to make? Okay, I want to, in the sake of time, spend a little bit of time on what I'm going to call relationship killers. How to destroy a marriage. Well, I don't have all of the answers to that. I don't even have all the ways, but I'm going to share with you a few, and then I'll be interested in your comments. One way I believe to destroy a marriage would simply be the word retaliation. Hurting back. The inclination is to release pain by hurting back to the person that we feel has inflicted pain. When we are hurt, it's our tendency to release that hurt through communication and through striking back. When X is hurt by Y, sometimes it leads to infidelity. Sometimes X wants Y to suffer like they have suffered. Sometimes it takes the form of what we'd call active aggression. Violence, vindictiveness, revenge, cruelty can even lead to physical abuse, but more times than not, probably in our relationships, it would be emotional and verbal abuse. Sometimes it takes the form of passive aggression. And passive aggression in a marriage would be, well, if he's going to be like that, I'll just always be late. And I know that gets his goat. Or forgetfulness. Sometimes it takes the form of loss or pretended loss of sexual appetite. The unwillingness to communicate, stubbornness, and rebellion. Sometimes we'll cloak that in what we will call righteous aggression. Well, I have the right to hurt back because they hurt me. But that is seldom, that is never true. The old cliche, two wrongs never make a right. Another way I believe we can kill our marriages or certainly harm them, I would call negativism. Sometimes we get into a relationship and we think there is simply no way to fix this. Well, I will grant you that in some cases, if the other person is totally unwilling, there is no way we can make them fix it. But there is always ways that we can try to fix it. There are no irreconcilable differences. There are simply irreconcilable people who won't reconcile their differences. All marriages can be good, and if the parties are willing, all marriages can be fixed and can be strengthened. It is very, very common for me and probably any of the rest of you that have attempted to help people in their marriage, you quickly come to the conclusion that they do not want to fix it. I have never been very good at helping people fix things they don't want to fix. It is infinitely easy to help people fix things that they do want to fix. So our attitude in this is extremely important. There is nothing more deadly than negativism and pessimism. In fact, if couples could be given a vaccine against pessimism, I think the divorce rate would drop dramatically. There was a study done by Dr. Martin Selvig with dogs at the University of Pennsylvania. And in this experiment, the dogs were given a minor shock that they could get away from if they just jump over a very short little partition. And he found that some of the dogs learned, and they jumped over that partition and never got shocked again. Some of the dogs just laid down and just let it shock them. When they looked into this a little further, he found that the dogs that just laid down and allowed themselves to be shocked had been used in a previous experiment using shock. And in that experiment, there was no way that they could get away from being shocked. So when they got shocked, they just assumed there was no hope. So they just laid down and lived with it. What had enveloped those dogs is sometimes what can envelop us in our marriages is a sense of hopelessness. And I understand that, as I've said, it takes two to fix a marriage. But when hopelessness overtakes us, then our energies and our efforts to fix any kind of problems really for us. Optimists look for solutions. Pessimists look for problems. The Bible, in this sense, I believe, calls the fix hope. It's the word hope, or the concept of hope, is used over 80 times in the New Testament. It is so important. In Colossians chapter 1, verses 4 and 5, love springs from hope. Hebrews 6:19, hope is the anchor of the soul. Romans 5:5, hope does not disappoint. That is a key element into saving our marriages. Another one that I will give you that I believe is a marriage killer is worry. Worry, worry, worry. Study after study has been done that the vast majority of the things you and I worry about never happen. A few of additional ones we can't control. Roughly not 9 to 10% of the things you and I worry about we have any control over. But worry is a marriage killer. Jealousy is a form of worry. I worry that maybe they're not going to be faithful. Worry is an energy drainer. Paul talks about that in Philippians chapter 4, verses 4 through 7, where he says, don't be anxious, but take things to the Lord in prayer. Peter, writing in 1 Peter, talks about how important prayer is in the marriage. 1 Peter chapter 3, verse 7, how that when we have trouble in our marriages, it will hinder our prayer. A couple of others that I will mention and then pause. Money. I don't know really quite personally how to relate to this, because that has never really personally been a stress for us. Not that there haven't been times when we could use more. It just never was a stressor. But they say that difficulties over money is probably number one or number two in marriage stressors. And I guess one of the reasons, I believe that, one of the reasons I have a little trouble relating to that is when we had less money, it was almost as if we were happier. And that doesn't, don't take from that that we're unhappy now or that we've got a lot of money. But I've shared this with some of you. You know, those first year of marriage, you're pretty convinced you're going to go broke because you just don't have enough money. So when Donna and I got married, Kraft macaroni and cheese, 3 for $1. Oh, did we inhale that? You could go almost all day on $1. Hate it. But I didn't hate it then. I know I've shared this with some of you, but Donna, in our first year of marriage, we were still in the apartment, she made oatmeal. And oatmeal's a good buy, good nutrition. So she made a big pot of oatmeal on Monday. Well, we couldn't eat it all, so we warmed it up Tuesday. Well, when you warm up oatmeal, you have to keep adding water to it, because it gets... Friday, we had more oatmeal than we started with. And as wonderful a cook as she is, 5 days of oatmeal. I know what I want to say. I just don't know if I got the guts to say it. Well, I'm going to say it. It doesn't make you happy, but it makes you regular. Okay? But now we look back on those, and those are funny. And I can eat it now. And maybe someday we'll have to eat it. But it really is what we make out of it, isn't it? Ladies, and I would say this certainly to those who haven't yet chosen their mates, but if you have chosen a mate, and most of you have, not all of you, you need to think through, can I be happy on his salary? And the answer to that needs to be yes. Now, I'm not saying by that that a woman cannot work out of the home. I personally hate to see that when the children are young, unless it is absolutely necessary, but that's an opinion, not a commandment. But if you enter, man or woman, enter into a marriage and you feel you have to have two incomes in order to make it, I would personally urge you to rethink it or hold off, because number one, you may not have two incomes, and number two, if you're going to have children, they deserve the raising by the parents.
Amen.
There is no daycare that is better than a mom, a Christian mom. Let me phrase that. That is simply a fact. And I see more and more Christian couples deciding for the woman to go back when it appears to me there is not a financial need for it. There is a financial want for it, not a financial need. I hope I did not offend you by saying that, and I know some of you ladies have worked and have done an excellent job raising your families. But really think that through. When we got married, Donna worked. When the boys came, she quit. When the boys got older, she went back. The irony of that is when we could have used the money the most, we had the least. And now that we don't need it quite as much, she's back working just to keep herself busy. But we do not regret that for one iota. I could go to work knowing that my children were under the care of a Christian woman. And that meant an awful lot to me. Okay. In most marriages, there's what we call the spender and the saver. Occasionally, you get two spenders. When that happens, you've got a disaster. Occasionally, you get two savers. When that happens, you've got a disaster. So, you need that balance. In our case, I was the saver, she was the spender. Now, we're kind of in the middle, and we do pretty good in terms of agreement. But again, budgeting is important. So if you're early in your, well, any stage in your marriage, live off the husband's income. If the wife works, that's fine. Use that for the future or for generosity. But I've never regretted not living beyond our means. I had someone come to us when we were, I don't know how old we were, 35. I was still in secular work, and the lady said, you know, you guys are living under your means. I took that as a real compliment. I took that as a tremendous, and she was right. We probably were. Our house wasn't as nice as maybe it could have been at that time. But I've never regretted that. Because when you don't live beyond your means, then that's one thing you don't have to worry about. You just don't have to worry about. I'm going to pause here and let others comment on any of those marriage killers or maybe other things you've seen that have been stressors in marriage that maybe we could learn from each other as we go along. So if anybody has a comment or a question you would like to ask, I'll pause. Matt, Larry over here.
Larry Meek. Vincennes, Indiana congregation. Okay. Larry Meek, Vincennes, Indiana congregation. I learned a lesson, several of them from John and the other speakers since I've been here, but I stay at the Pinecrest cabins and I learned a lesson in their parking lot. And I think it's good that we all hear it. I was talking to a gentleman there, and he said, well, my daughter has a degree, a PhD from, I'm not sure I remember it was a local college somewhere here. It doesn't make any difference. And he says, and she went then to Chicago and earned another PhD. He says, but now she's home taking care of the most important business that she's ever had. And of course, I think I figured that out immediately. She was taking care of her children. And I think that's a good lesson for some people.
Thank you, Larry. Yeah, I can live without three cars and three bathrooms. I'm not sure I could have lived without a godly woman raising my children. Tom, and then Steve.
In the process of time, particularly when children are being reared, religious differences, if people have married outside the Lord, that can be a stressful thing in marriage.
Yes, it can, and there's been statistics, and we can argue with these, but the last ones I saw, and I think maybe we do a little bit better than this, but if a woman is in the church and brings her children to the church and her husband's not a member of the church, roughly 10 to 15% of those children grow up being Christians. Interestingly enough, if a man is in the church and the woman isn't, about 40% of those children end up being in the church. Which, guys, I think just leads to the fact that we need to recognize how our children look up to us as that authoritative, and I hate to say God figure, but I think there is some merit to that. But if both parents are members of the church, the number goes up into the 60s and 70s. No guarantees, but it helps. Steve?
John, this is Steve Finney from Grand Haven. The question I had is in reference to Ephesians, the fifth chapter, verses 33, and the specific question is, verse 25, and it deals with this topic of maybe negativism. The question I had is, in verse 33 it says, "Nevertheless, let every one of you in particular so love his wife even as himself." Many of us husbands, and I've seen husbands in our local congregation, think, well, we can maybe get within the ballpark of loving our wife like we love ourselves and being less selfish. But in verse 25, it seems like that call that husbands are to love our wives even as Christ loved the church is an impossible task for us to do. And the part about negativism, what I've seen is, and this is in some couples where their marriage is struggling, this oftentimes with husbands, maybe even young husbands, I've seen wives maybe beat their husbands over the head with this, is, well, if you behave towards me like Christ did the church and loved the church, then I wouldn't behave like I do. It almost, in some instances I've seen, demoralizes the husband where he says, what is the use? How can I be like Christ in this situation?
Sure.
Do you have any comments on that?
Yeah, I do. Because usually the second phrase that comes out is the husband will say, well, if you respected me like it says here, I'd love you. And then we get into this vicious, vicious circle. And to me, that I'm talking in generalities because I don't know if you got anybody in mind. Probably you got us all in mind. I think it really goes down to selfishness. What we're saying is you go first. Okay, wives, you respect us. Husbands, you love us. Okay, I'll do it, but you go first. If we get this attitude of let's all go first, then it works out. But if we approach this, well, if you treat me better, I treat you better, that's retaliation. I believe that is retaliation. And often this sometimes takes a form in sexual issues too. Usually it's the husband that has, in the younger years, the greater sexual appetite. But I've been involved with couples where it's the other way around. The wife has the greater sexual appetite. It seems to me that whoever has the lesser sexual appetite tends to hold the power, because they can do without better than the other would, and so they use that as a club over the wife's head. I don't know where I put it, but I had a quote here that I liked. I can't find it, but the gist of it was that if women had men's, in general, if women had men's sexual appetites, we'd have a lot of people, but we'd never get anything done. And if it was the other way around, we'd get a lot done, but we wouldn't have any people. So, I'm sure there are exceptions to that. Did I get that? I got that close. You got the gist of that, didn't you? Okay. So, we got a lot of people. We get some things done. So, maybe we found a happy compromise. But back to your comment. That is a form of negativism, but I view if I understood your comment, that's almost a form of retaliation. Well, you treat me good, and then I'll treat you good. Well, that's selfishness, which is which is American marriage is selfish, but Christian marriage isn't. Christian marriage is all about being selfless, just like Christ was selfless when he gave his life for us. And you're right, we can't, maybe in this life, reach the perfection of Christ's love for the church, but that's the mountain peak that we need to be looking at. And I think women in general, now there's some women that are jerks, but women in general will respect a man who they think is really trying to love them to that extent, even if he sometimes falls short. Come on, ladies, you know, you're smart enough to know we're not perfect, but I think you appreciate our efforts. And if you don't, we're in trouble, because that's where we're at. Anybody else besides Eric?
Eric Owens, Prince Road.
I haven't called on you.
That's all right. I got the mic and it's on.
I still haven't. Eric, would you like to say something?
Please.
Okay.
Please. You earlier typified agape love as deep spiritual love, and I think sometimes we see that as nearly unattainable. And I'm no great Greek scholar, but what I've come to understand as far as agape for me, anyway, is it's duty love, where you're doing the right thing because it's the right thing to do. God so loved the world, not because the world was lovable and he felt great about just embracing the world by giving his son to the world, but he agape'd the world. Why? Because it was the right thing to do. And this issue of retaliation, or you first, if we truly embrace this concept of loving because it's the right thing to do, doing the right thing and being love, rather than it being something that we emotionally feel as, oh, this is deep and this is spiritual, or I'm really getting the warm fuzzies over this, I think we miss the point, and we're misunderstanding perhaps that God type of love is that God gave us Jesus because he had purposed that was the right thing to do, and thus he did it. And if we treat one another in that fashion when we're not so lovable, we'll get back to that point where we're more lovable and that we can feel that affection once again.
Okay, I would agree with that. I think agape love does have an element of duty to it, because God doesn't command us to have feelings. He commands us to do things. But I don't want to relegate our marriages to a sense of duty, because there is... Agape love to me is a sense of duty, but agape love is wanting what's best for the other person. And so I should approach my wife, and you should approach your mates as, what can I do that is best for them, even when they're not acting lovable? Because there's oftentimes... C.S. Lewis does a nice job in Mere Christianity, I think, differentiating that. I'll just read a little bit. As Eric was saying, I turned around, that's what I was grabbing. He said, being in love... Now, he's talking about the emotions there. Being in love is a good thing, but it is not the best thing. There are many things below it, but there are also things above it. We cannot make it the basis of our whole life. It is a noble feeling, but being in love is still a feeling. And no feeling can be relied on to last in its full intensity or even to last at all. Remember I said after the honeymoon has to come a marriage. In fact, the state of being in love usually does not last, at least at that level. But the converse course is to be in love. But of course, ceasing to be in love need not mean ceasing to love. Love, in the agape sense, is a deep unity maintained by the will and deliberately strengthened by habit, reinforced by grace which both parties ask and receive from God. They can retain this love even when each would easily, if they allowed themselves, be in love with somebody else. In love first moves them to promise fidelity, but this quieter agape love enables them to keep the engine of marriage, it runs. Being in love is the explosion that starts it. I hope that made sense to you, because that's probably better than anything I will say. But what he is saying is, when we meet our mates and we fall in love, that's an explosion, for want of a better phrase. But it's often an emotional feeling. But as we develop our marriages, agape love takes, I think, more front and center. And maybe the Roman candles don't go off every time you touch them, like it did the first year or two, but it's replaced by something far, far stronger. And that's that agape love. And the world doesn't know anything about that. And that's why, after 10, 15, 20 years of marriage, when people don't see Roman candles exploding every time they touch each other, they go looking for another set of fireworks. And usually end up taking their baggage with them, so their fireworks are wet when they find them, so it doesn't work. Should I write that down? So if anybody has wet fireworks, I'm sorry, Eldon.
That verse that you mentioned in Proverbs, "For iron sharpens iron."
Yes, sir.
Isn't that one of the reasons for being so important that the elder have a wife?
I think it's one of the very important reasons. He said, for an elder having a wife, because, yeah, there's times when other people aren't going to tell us what we need to hear, and sometimes our mates aren't willing to tell us what we need to hear, but we sometimes still need to hear it. I think there are other reasons why an elder needs to have a wife, but that would fit into it.
This is Kimber Wright again. I was thinking that if we would just be more grateful for what we have, and the scripture about how the angels watch what we do, if you think of a higher reason for your marriage, it really can help you through some rough times to reevaluate how good you have it and what a great choice you made. Because other people see that your husband or your wife is really great. So why do we take it for granted?
Yeah. A personal example popped into my head, but I'm not sure that this is a place to do that. But I think that's good. Sometimes you'll have someone come up to you and say, "Boy, you're really lucky to be married to that person." And it's a bit of a wake-up call. They're probably right, but we tend to forget that. I'll go that far. And we need to remember how blessed many of us are. Blessed many of us are. If not most of us. Maybe all of us. I don't know if anybody out there outside had anything to say. I'm not hearing, so that's fine if you don't. We got Joe over here, man.
Joe Dunn from Carlinville. There's two things I want to say. The one's on that 33rd verse there in Ephesians 5. It says to love your wife as you love yourself. I think sometimes we need to love our wives better than we love ourselves, because what maybe might please me doesn't please her. And I think, well, you know, it's all right for me, it should be all right for her, but sometimes it's not. And so though, kind of got to keep that in mind, you know, are we really doing the thing that our wives want that makes them happy? Just because it makes us happy, that's not meaning that it's going to necessarily make them happy. And the other thing is, you know, when you're sitting out in the cold, if you don't go out and get the wood and you put it in the stove, don't expect no heat out of the stove. So,
I think that's an old Jamaican proverb.
Yeah. Yeah.
But it's true.
That way it stops you from chasing your tail.
It's still true. You know, and we're getting down to the last 10 minutes here, and I don't want to wax philosophical, so I'll just wax a little personal, and I hope Donna doesn't mind. I've used this analogy before. There are so many different ways to say I love you than saying I love you. Every morning, my wife tells me she loves me. Now, she doesn't always tell me in words, but I'm going to tell you how she tells me, and this is a little thing, and you apply it to your marriage. When we first got married, you would expect she was by far the neater and tidiest of the two of us, and you would be right. But there was one difference we had, and it was based on how we were raised. In my family, the toothpaste tube, you always rolled it from the bottom to where it was just right. In her family, you just grabbed it like a gorilla and squeezed. Now, I remember, she's by far the neater person. And for a year or two, that would just... I didn't say anything, but it was a struggle. I just look at that and I say, I married this. And I mentioned this. Yeah, she's still laughing. I mentioned this in a class like this. And nothing else was said about it. And you know what happened? Every time I now brush my teeth, it's rolled up from the end. Not because that's her natural inclination, and she's far tidier. She's doing it because she found out that meant something to me. So every time I brush my teeth, she says, I love you. And of course, after I brush them, she says, thank you. But, so it works. But in your marriage, there's going to be things like that that are nonverbals. It may be body language. It may be looks. It's probably going to be multiple things where we can each tell our mates that we love them. You know, I tried to one time, well, more than once, but not often, a few years ago, take the trash out. It was January. Well, it was slippery. So I fell and dislocated my elbow, and she had to take me to the emergency room, and they had to knock me out. It was about that far, which I took as a sign from God that men aren't meant to take out the trash. So I don't show my love for her in that way anymore, but I'll find other ways. I'm not trying to be terribly flippant, but we are all so funny. But aren't there things that your mate will do for you? I remember a couple in Anaheim, California. I won't mention their names. You would know them. And the wife said one day, she was sharing with me, I had a terrible day. I came home from the grocery. I had like 5 sack loads. I took them in. I went to change, and I came out, and my husband had put the groceries up. And that meant so much to her. Now, I don't know if he was just being nice or trying to get bonus points or both. But it meant a lot. And there are things we can do for each other that seem small, but in a marriage relationship, they're not small. They tell our mates how much they mean to us. Anything we can do like that sometimes speaks louder than all the I love yous in the world. Now, I'm not against saying I love you. Well, to some of you, I would say that. Not to all of you. But actions and body language really, really can jump out. So I was reading in another article about a woman who was having trouble respecting her husband. I talked about respect. So her marriage counselor said, just go home and go in and tell your husband how much you appreciate him and you respect him. So she did. She said the next thing she knew, he was in the kitchen fixing supper. So she said, this is working good. So the next day, she said, I really respect you. That night, he did the laundry. She went back to her marriage counselor and he said, we got something going. I'm going to get a trip to Hawaii out of this before it's all over. You know, you can motivate people, not manipulate, but you can motivate people to do things with simply showing them love and respect that we can't get with any lectures or any classes. I pause now and see if you've got any toward the end comments before I wrap up. We've got 5 minutes and there's no use quitting before the classes come back. Dwayne over here.
Yeah, Dwayne Stoops from Riverside wrote, John, I'm sure you probably have heard this, the concept of the love bank. It fits in, you know, where you have to, you need to make deposits, and when it gets to a certain threshold, you fall in love, or when you make withdrawals and it hits that bottom threshold, the relationship, you fall out of love, and just like with a bank account, a bank relationship, it probably ends. But all these little things that we do, the looks that we give, so many different things can make deposits in the love bank of our spouse or of anyone. And then on the opposite, there are all those things that you were talking about that makes withdrawals. And we need to keep that balance up above that threshold.
Yeah. When you go to a love bank, make a deposit. Don't take out a loan. Okay. I'm sorry. You got one?
John, I've got a pretty good one. When I was younger, I had one of those days like people do sometimes, and I dropped an egg, and it made me so mad, I picked another one up and threw it right on top of it. My husband said, "Okay, honey, you've lost it. Go sit down. I'll clean it up." My brother said, "I'd have made you clean it up."
Thank you. We just had a slight disturbance, so I didn't catch all of that, but I hope you did. Anybody else? We got Paul up here.
It's Paul Bratcher from Lone Jack. I don't know, maybe some people are born more with kind of what you talk about, the agape love, but it's something that I've had to learn. You get married and you have perceptions on how it's going to be, and it's not always that way. Sometimes it takes years to somewhat figure somebody out. Some of the younger folks, it doesn't always come naturally to some of us, and we have to learn how to love.
Excellent comment. I would say it takes all of us a long time to figure each other out. Donna's still working on figuring me out, and she's doing better than most. But the key is you're working on. The key is you're working on. I want to close with this quote from, and I didn't write down the man's name, it was from a lawyer, a U.S. attorney. He said, "It's easier in the U.S. to walk away from a marriage than it is to walk away from a commitment to buy a used car. Most contracts cannot be unilaterally terminated. A marriage commitment, however, can be broken by practically anyone at any time without a cause." And sadly, he's right. But the fact that it can be broken by the laws of our land doesn't mean it's broken by the Lord of our universe. "Till death do us part" of marriage is not simply an ideal. It's a God-ordained command. A willful agreement to keep love alive. Commitment is the cerebral part of love. And when we don't have a cerebral part to our love, then it's almost always destined to have a death. I appreciate the time to be with you. I don't know if the classes are back yet, but I've got 10:30 or 11:30, so I'm going to close up my part, and then when the classes come back, as appropriate, we'll have our invitation.